Special coverage from the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference is brought to you by Victoria Gold Corp.
Welcome back to SOAR Financially and welcome back to the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the @JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the SOAR Financial Group. Really appreciate you joining us here back in Vancouver. And I'm joined by Grant Williams. Grant, been looking forward to this interview for a long, long time.
Hey, Kai.
Really looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, good to see you. Good to see you. It's good to be back in Vancouver. I love this place.
Absolutely.
I love it in July more than I love it in January, but hey, that's all right.
I don't mind the rain. I lived here for 3.5 years and I don't mind the rain. I have to admit it.
You're a better man than me.
Maybe week three gets a little boring, but...
I'm English. We know all about the rain.
Take that. Absolutely. Grant, we have to talk markets. We have to talk about what is happening in the world on a financial and global scale, of course. Let's start with, since you're the first time guest on the show, a bit of a macro overview. Like, what's the state of the economy right now?
Well, which economy? I mean, that's
let's start globally, and then we can sort of hone down a little bit, because there's a lot of... We discussed off camera a little bit as well.
Yeah.
There are a lot of interlinking factors. So let's start off globally, and then we can work U.S. and maybe some of the other nations that we discussed earlier.
Well, look, it's an interesting question, right? Because for a long time, you could talk about the global economy and give an answer. But for the first time, it's not as simple as that. It's not as though everything's going in the same direction. There's pockets of stress. You know, the Chinese economy is struggling. That hasn't been the case for a while. The U.S. economy is either booming or about to collapse, depending on who you listen to. Germany's a basket case. The U.K. is in trouble. Some of the emerging market economies are pretty strong. You know, Mexico's doing okay. So suddenly you've kind of got all these cross currents. And I think that's the source of some of the problems, is that you've suddenly got to have a different strategy for different parts of the world. And it's just made the whole thing a lot more complicated. And that's to be expected. You know, we're at the end of a cycle where we've been through this short-lived but dramatic interest rate hike cycle, which has upended an awful lot of people's belief system about the entire financial world, right? And it's predicated upon low rates. So we're in a period now where there's an awful lot of uncertainty, and that is going to feed through to markets, it's going to feed through to investor sentiment. And so, you know, right now, for the next year, I suspect, you are going to see, I think, a lot more volatility, a lot more swings in markets and in economic data, and that's going to make the business of investing that much more difficult.
What do you focus on when you try to make sense of it all? Like you said, there's so many factors going in, but what kind of filters do you use to sort of weed out the basic crap?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you're trying to achieve with investment, and B, the kind of style that you're trying to...
Let's say generate wealth and a positive return on the portfolio. It doesn't have to be 50 or 100%, let's say reasonable
right,
return
but,
of like
okay.
5 to 10%.
Okay,
year,
so let's start with the fact that you can get 5% pretty easily now, right, without taking any risk. That's a really important change. So if that is your goal, you know, you've been handed a way to do that with minimum stress.
Beating inflation.
Well,
inflation numbers.
Yeah, I mean, that's, everyone has their own inflation. Right? That's the reality of it. Away from food and shelter, everybody has a different set of variables that go into their own inflation basket. But right now, you know, for me, it's a case of understand what your objectives are, understand how your portfolio is constructed to meet those objectives, and then focus on those things. If you try and focus on everything, it gets too complicated. It's going to get way noisier than it is now, and you're liable to get lost in that noise. So, you know, trying to be an expert on the US and uranium and China and natural gas and ESG, all these things that we've all tried to be experts on, is going to be a lot more problematic. So I think focus is the most important thing to remember.
Thanks for clarifying that, because like one of the mantras of our channel is understanding the macro to understand the micro.
Yeah.
Macro means everything that's involving the gold price and commodity prices, more or less, to understand why are the mining stocks not performing, right? That's the ending question, right? We can talk about that later.
Yeah.
But, so that means like we have whole source of information. We got to funnel it through to understand, okay, why didn't the gold stocks move this week when gold reached a new all-time high?
Well, it's interesting.
Right?
That why question is an interesting one, because, of course, we all want a reason why. Because once we have a reason why, we can make sense of things. But there's never a why didn't gold stocks move. There just never is an answer to that question, and everyone searches for it. So if you have a realistic time horizon for owning your gold stocks, if you are buying them because you think they're going to double in a week, if they don't double in a week, get out. It's simple. If you're buying gold mining stocks because you think that the next 10 years are going to be incredibly bullish for gold, don't sell them because they fall 25%, because that's what they do. They're very volatile stocks. So again, it's really about understanding what's in your portfolio, why it's there, and what your time horizon is, because that will dictate how you respond to swings in the assets themselves.
If you were to pick three macro trends right now, which ones would you choose, and which ones, you know, like also would you like to discuss further, you know, which are really important to you right now?
Japan is one of them. We'll talk about that in a minute. I think Japan is going to be something that people are going to once again get familiarized with, and there's a lot of money to be made in Japan, I think. I think inflation is still a very important subject to have a handle on. Everyone thinks it's dead and the Fed have hung the mission accomplished banners up and everything's gone away. I don't think that's the case. I think it's still there. We saw just today a big strike at one of the universities in California, all the faculty walking out wanting much bigger wages. I think we're going to see more of that. And wage inflation is the worst inflation of all in terms of how entrenched it gets. You can lower prices of food if you increase them. It's tough to lower wages once you increase them. So I think inflation is still something that we need to worry about. And I come back to gold. I think gold is, it's time for gold now. I think all the pieces are in place for gold to become a much bigger part of the macro conversation. I think the reasons for owning gold have been strong for a while, but they're starting to be strong for a lot more different groups of people, particularly the central banks. So we've seen them buying more gold the last 2 years than they have since 1950. And that's important because they don't care what the price is. They just need to own it and diversify out of their currency reserves into a neutral reserve asset. So I think there's a lot of tailwinds for gold. So for me, Japan, gold, and inflation are the three things that I'm kind of keeping an eye on.
Let's dive a little deeper on those topics, because Japan is a topic nobody really talks about, because I think people don't understand what's going on there. A few commentators have mentioned, of course, the yen dropping crazy and the Nikkei exploding and really generating some wealth. And there's been, you know, discussions about the yen-dollar pair trade, meaning you borrow in yen and then you buy U.S. bonds because it just makes sense. You can make money on it, the arbitrage, right? But Japan is a topic nobody understands. And the 250% debt-to-GDP ratio as well, everybody's trying to figure out why that economy hasn't collapsed entirely as well.
Yeah.
Maybe you could clarify a few things there.
Yeah, look, I'm biased because I began my career in Japan in the 80s when it was the hottest market on the face of the planet. You know, Japan was where everybody was going to make money. And if you look at the performance of the Nikkei through the 80s, it was extraordinary. It was like the NASDAQ in the 90s. That market stopped going up on December the 31st, 1989. And it started going down. It's been going down for most of the intervening 30 plus years. But, you know, things are changing. And the Nikkei is plus or minus 40,000 now, is about to break out to new highs for the first time, say, since 1989, which when you think what's happened in the US and other major markets, that's extraordinary. But more important than that is the fact that the over that time, corporate Japan has really got its balance sheet in much better shape because it's had to. The companies have become much better stewards of shareholder capital, returning capital to shareholders, buybacks, dividends, all these things that were really not part of corporate Japan before. They've made great progress. And you can go to Japan if you're a stock picker and you can find world-class companies trading on single-digit PEs, trading below book value. You can find all the kind of things that value investors want in a big economy, in a first world economy that has challenges, and we'll talk about those in a second. But finally, if you're looking for a big, liquid, deep market that can accept capital, you know, people say there's no game in town over the US. Japan's not as big as the US, but it's certainly a lot bigger than a lot of other markets and can absorb an awful lot of capital. Added to which, the Japanese are the biggest creditors in the world. So there's an awful lot of Japanese capital overseas that when we start to see a positive yield in Japan is going to start to come home. And when that changes, when those capital flows out of Japan and into US stocks and bonds particularly reverses, it's going to change things dramatically. And so, you know, Japan's challenges, the demographic challenge is a clear one. You know, the country is, the population is shrinking, has been for the last 8 years. That needs to be addressed. It probably won't be in the short order. So it's something to be aware of. I don't think it's a clear and present danger in the next couple of years, but it's something to be aware of. Debt to GDP, you talked about that before we started filming. The numbers are incredibly high. The Bank of Japan has a massive bloated balance sheet. It has cornered the Japanese sovereign bond market, which is not a good thing. And so there are these challenges that the extraordinary monetary policy has put in front of Japan. But with the change of governor from Corot de Sand to Wade de Sand last year, they have a chance to kitchen sink all this and say that was then, this is now, which they're starting to do. And they've talked overtly about normalizing interest rates. And it's really important to understand what that means. You know, the policy rate in Japan has been negative 10 basis points for a long time. They've basically had ZERP for two decades. Talking about normalizing policy rates is a big deal in Japan. Even if the rate goes from negative 10 basis points to positive 10 basis points, it doesn't really make a difference. But the message it sends and the fact that the Japanese are finally going to try and normalize rates, whatever that means. But if you've got Japanese rates to 1%, if you've got the Japanese policy rate to 1%, the shift that that would precipitate in global bond funds, the money that that would bring home into Japan from overseas bonds, the effect that would have on the yen, which is the currency, as you said, the carry trade, everybody's net short the yen effectively, whether they know it or not. These are profound changes. And so I just think that finally Japan is started to make the right noises. You know, it doesn't hurt having someone like Warren Buffett putting a lot of money to work in Japan about 18 months ago. That got people sitting up and taking notice. There is value in Japan, and it is a stock picker's market. It is a place where you can go and practice the art of investment that you can't do many places anymore because of ETFs. Yeah. And for me, I just think it's a place where there's going to be some real opportunity this year to make money.
Just to follow up on that as well, like higher base rate as well in Japan, like can Japan afford it at the debt level?
Well, this is my point. From minus 10 to minus 10 basis points to plus 10 basis points, it's about the signal, not the number.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but if you get to 100 basis points all of a sudden,
right,
a little higher. Because.
But again, the Japanese central bank has a lot of bonds on their books, which they own at, you know, zero interest rates. Once you start seeing that capital come home, and the Japanese, you know, effectively pension money market accounts have their negotiations in March when they set the rate. They're talking about that being 75 basis points this year. So suddenly at 75 basis points, there's an awful lot of demand for Japanese domestic debt from domestic pension funds institutions. So there is a scenario, it's unlikely to be smooth, but which the Bank of Japan can actually let all this debt go into the pension funds. You know, there are ways they can get around this. There's the famous $1 trillion platinum coin, the zero coupon, all that stuff, right? But you have to realize that Japan has been doing this for 20 years and it hasn't fallen into the sea. The economy's gotten better, not worse. The corporate balance sheets have gotten better, not worse. And yes, it's a massive problem, but is it an insurmountable one? I think it isn't. And I think that the opportunity on offer in the Japanese stock market is such that you can look past this with one eye and not think that precludes any investment in Japan. So I just don't think it does, really.
I like talking about Japan because I always bring it up also in conversation because I'm looking for a way for the U.S. maybe moving forward as well. And I'm looking for endgame scenarios or potential scenarios, how this all could unfold and play out. And Japan, of course, is where it is right now. Do you see the U.S. moving in that direction as well? Because it feels like we keep kicking down the can down the road.
Yeah.
And looking at the debt to GDP ratio, for example, as an example, we still got a long way to go in the U.S. to getting to the Japanese levels.
But it shouldn't.
So I'm sure there's.
So it's an interesting one. But it shouldn't. The U.S. should never really be able to get to Japan levels because the currency is so important to the rest of the world. So it should matter. You know, Japan's been able to do this in relative peace and quiet because China has kind of taken the attention of the world as it's come up. Japan's been able to get its corporate balance sheet in much better shape, kind of quietly without anybody really paying attention to it. The U.S. doesn't have that luxury. You know, with the Congressional Budget Office estimates of what the deficit is going to be for the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years, the U.S. is going to face a reckoning for sure. We don't know what it's going to be, but the numbers don't work. They haven't worked for some time. It hasn't mattered, but it will matter. I just don't know when. And when it matters, the world is going to need a home for a lot of capital that is currently sitting in the U.S. if people lose faith and confidence in the Treasury and the U.S. Central Bank, which I'm amazed they haven't already. If the election makes people concerned, which either way it has the clear potential to do, I think the U.S. is going to face challenges. It doesn't mean it's not still the biggest economy in the world or the most powerful market or the home for the most capital. But at the margin, we're starting to see shifts away from that. And that's all it really needs for other countries to benefit.
Thanks for covering Japan. Like, I haven't talked to anybody really about it, so I love spending a lot of time.
I'm sure a lot of people think, why is he talking about Japan? But for me, it's interesting again after 25 years.
No, it's a new angle for us on the channel as well, because we often touch on it, but we really never dive in deep. This quite honest, is a lack of expertise.
Who cares?
Well,
you're right. Who cares?
So, second topic you mentioned is inflation, and we just got the inflation numbers last week as well. They actually were higher than expected.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? Because inflation fears seem to be coming back a little bit into the markets. True inflation is down below 2%, yep. But all the other inflation indicators are pointing up. You mentioned wage inflation as well. What's your opinion really on inflation? How sticky is it? Do we see a massive rebound? Do we see 9% inflation again?
No, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. And if you think about that, for the longest time, it was almost impossible to conceive inflation above 2% because they couldn't get it there no matter what they did. So could it get to 9% again? Absolutely it could. It would take probably actions by the Federal Reserve in terms of slashing interest rates to see inflation get out of control again. But the wage price stuff does worry me because it's very, very sticky inflation. And so I always worry when they hang the mission accomplished banners, and they did that at the tail end of last year, talking about how they've got it under control and talking about, you know, signaling cuts because they know that the market needs that promise of lower cost of capital in order to function properly now. And that's the world they've created with their policies. So they have to try and maintain it. Ultimately, it is doomed to failure. It just is. And the math just doesn't work after a certain level. But again, everybody is very happy to play along because it's easy to make money when interest rates are low and asset prices are rising. So people tend not to put their fingers in their ears and shout la la la. But when rates are going up, and when inflation is a problem, we saw what happened in the bond market through last year. We saw what happened in Silicon Valley and the Signature Bank back in March. Once these problems become real and they have to be faced, facing them means banks going out of business and, you know, prices going up and people out in the streets and all these things that we've kind of forgotten about since the 70s. So to say that inflation as a concern is over, I think is way too premature. Way too crunchy.
Well, we had Nobel laureates come out and say we've beaten the war on inflation. We won the war on inflation. I was a bit,
yeah. One particular Nobel laureate. I mean,
it's quite controversial.
Don't say his name in case you summon him.
It's just stressing. You say it three times like Beetlejuice.
Exactly so. Right. We don't want that happening.
No, let's not. So let's wrap up the inflation debate because everybody sees that onshoring is another trend as well, or reshoring, whatever you want to call it, bringing production back home comes with cost and wage inflation.
Look, it does. And the question is it a choice or is it? Is it a policy? You know, is it something that they decide they're going to do, or is it something they have to do because other countries are forming blocks left and right that are antagonistic towards the U.S.? The U.S. needs to secure its supply chains. COVID's proven that. And the only way to really do that is to move it back onshore or to friendly countries. Maybe move it to Europe. Mexico is obviously a favorite destination right now. Moving it to Europe is expensive. Moving it onshore is even more expensive. The chances are that's going to lead to higher wages and higher costs. So we just have to deal with that. And I think after so many years of low inflation, we just have to accept that we're in a world of higher inflation for a while. And it's just going to be that way.
Fantastic. All right. Last topic we need to touch on is your topic of the conference here as well, because we're at the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. It is gold. Your title is called Rise and Shine. Gold has risen. Is it shining?
I think this year and the next couple of years could be big years for gold. I'm very happy to talk about gold often, but I don't normally come out and say, I think this is going to be a good year. I've done it two or three times, and my track record has been pretty decent with those times. I don't think of it as something to buy and sell. I think of it as a liquidity reserve. I think of it as a hedge against inflation. I think of it as a hedge against uncertainty. And I don't think about the price of gold. I want to own gold. I want to keep my savings in gold and then exchange it for things that I want to own more at a given point in time. And the point I was making in my presentation was you look at gold's purchasing power, not the price. So in 2008, for example, gold spiked into the Bear Stearns collapse.
Yeah.
Performed incredibly well. And then when Bear Stearns went under, it fell. And everybody was saying, what the hell's going on? Why gold's not supposed to fall in times of crisis? But it was liquidity, and people that had margin calls were selling gold because it's liquid capital. But importantly, as gold fell 30%, it quickly rebounded. The S&P went on to fall 65%. And so even though gold was down, your purchasing power increased. And that's how I try and get people to think about gold, is the price went down, but if you can buy twice as many units of the S&P today, even with a reduced price in gold, you might want to own the S&P more now because it's corrected 66%. So I just think of it as a liquidity reserve and capital and a thing to exchange for other assets as and when the relative values align. And if you think of it in those terms, you know, gold has done tremendously well. If you look at headline terms since 2000, when it bottomed, when the central bank stopped selling gold, it's outperformed the S&P, it's outperformed the Dow Jones, it's outperformed the S&P on a total return basis. And all you've had to do is sit there with it in a safety deposit box. You haven't had to worry about all the ups and downs of the market, which stocks to pick. It's just outperformed them. And I suspect that outperformance will actually increase if we get some instability in equity markets in the US particularly, which I fully expect to see before this year's out.
How geopolitical is the gold price right now?
It's becoming more so. Yeah, it's a great question. It's becoming more so because we are seeing central banks aggressively buying gold. And there's only so much of it. There's only so much additional supply every year. And when you have an increasing number of price insensitive buyers looking to acquire it, that tends to lead to higher prices. But more importantly, the reasons these central banks are trying to buy gold is because it's a national security imperative. You know, once the US Treasury froze Russian assets when they went across the borders of Ukraine, every single central bank in the world that owns dollar reserves was on notice that this could happen to you. And while the majority of them, I'm sure, think, well, we're on the same team as the US, we're not going to upset them, they can't take that chance now because it's been proven that it can happen. And if your reserves are a national security imperative, which they obviously are, you cannot have them at the whim of a capricious foreign government. And gold is essentially the only neutral reserve asset out there. And that explains why central banks are moving to acquire gold. And I think that is going to make gold more of a geopolitical asset. It's going to be a tailwind for the price. And I think that's a big part of why we're going to see a good year for gold this year.
Absolutely. And on that note, Grant, fantastic chatting with you. We have to wrap
up. My great pleasure.
Friends, we keep the conference and interviews a little bit shorter.
Totally fine by me.
Have you back later in the year, of course, as well, and see how the trends are developing, how Japan is doing, how we're doing on the inflation cycle and business cycle as well.
Anytime.
Where can we find more of your work?
Easy, grant-williams.com. That's it. Nice and simple. It's all there.
Fantastic. Awesome. Thank you so much, Grant. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You do this for a long, long time. And everybody else, thank you so much for tuning in. I really enjoyed this conversation with Grant Williams. Make sure to go follow him on his website. He's also on Twitter.
I am. I have TTMYGH, which is things that make you go.
I'll put that in the description.
Yeah,
you didn't catch that earlier. So really appreciate you tuning in. If you have any questions, any comments, put them down below. We do want to hear from you. And I know that 85% of you watching are not subscribed to the channel. Let's please change that. It helps us tremendously. Bringing guests like Grant on the program, we really appreciate it. And of course, we'll be back with lots more here from Vancouver. Thank you so much for joining us.